astrophysics for people in a hurry. The fourth. For all those who are too busy to read fat books, yet nonetheless seek a condiment of the cosmos. And preface. In recent years, no more than a week goes by without news of a cosmic discovery worthy of banner headlines. While media gatekeepers may have development interests in the universe, the rise in coverage likely comes from a genuine increase in the public's appetite for science. Evidence for this abounds from hit television shows inspired or informed by science to the success of science fiction films starring marquee actors and brought to the screen by celebrated producers and directors. And lately, theatrical release biopics featuring important scientists have become a genre unto itself. There's also widespread interest around the world in science festivals, science fiction conventions, and science documentaries for television. The highest grossing film of all time is by a famous director who set his story on a planet orbiting a distant star, and it features a famous actress who plays an astrobiologist. While most branches of science have ascended in this era, the field of astrophysics persistently rises to the top. I think I know why. At one time or another, every one of us has looked up at the night sky and wondered, what does it all mean? How does it all work? And what is my place in the universe? If you're too busy to absorb the cosmos via classes, textbooks, or documentaries, and you nonetheless seek a brief but meaningful introduction to the field, I offer you Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. In this slim volume, you will earn a foundational fluency in all the major ideas and discoveries that drive our modern understanding of the universe. If I've ever succeeded, you'll be culturally conversant in my field of expertise, and you just may be hungry for more. The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Number one, the greatest story ever told. The world has persisted many a long year, having once been set going in the appropriate motions. From these, everything follows. Acritius, circa 50 BC. In the beginning, nearly 14 billion years ago, all the space and all the matter and all the energy of the known universe was contained in a volume less than 1 trillionth the size of the period that ends the sentence. Conditions were so hot, the basic forces of nature that collectively describe the universe were unified. Though still unknown how it came into existence, the sub-pinpoint size cosmos could only expand rapidly in what today we call the Big Bang. Einstein's general theory of relativity put forth in 1916 gives us our modern understanding of gravity, in which the presence of matter and energy curves the fabric of space and time surrounding it. In the 1920s, quantum mechanics would be discovered, providing our modern account of all that is small, molecules, atoms, and some atomic particles. But these two understandings of nature are formally incompatible with one another, which set physicists off on a race to blend the theory of the small with the theory of the large into a single coherent theory of quantum gravity. Although we haven't yet reached the finish line, we know exactly where the high hurdles are. One of them, during the Planck era of the early universe. That's the interval of time from t equals zero up to t equals 45 seconds, 1 trillionth of a second after the beginning, before the universe grew 10 to the 35th meters, 100 billion trillion trillionths of a meter across. The German physicist Max Planck, after whom these unimaginable small quantities are named, introduced the idea of quantized energy in the 1900s. And is generally credited as the father of quantum mechanics. The clash between gravity and quantum mechanics poses no particular problem for the contemporary universe, Astrophysicists apply the tenets and the tools of general relativity and quantum mechanics to very different classes of problems. But in the beginning, during the Planck era, the large was small, and we suspect there must have been a kind of shotgun wedding between the two. Alas, the vows exchanged during that ceremony continue to elude us. And so no known laws of physics describe with any confidence the behavior of the universe over that time. We nonetheless expect that by the end of the Planck era, gravity wriggled loose from the other, still unified forces of nature achieving an independent identity nicely described by our current theories. Has the universe aged from 1,000 billion trillion trillions seconds, it continued to expand, diluting all concentrations of energy, and what remained of the unified forces split into the electroweak and the strong nuclear forces. Later still, the electroweak force split into the electromagnetic and the weak nuclear forces, laying bare the four distinct forces we have come to know and love, with the weak force controlling radioactive decay and the strong force binding the atomic nucleus, and the electromagnetic force binding molecules and gravity, binding bulk matter. A trillion of a second has passed since the beginning. All the while, the interplay of matter in the form of subatomic particles and the energy of the form of photons, massless vessels of light energy, that are as much waves as they are particles, are incessant. The universe was hot enough for these photons to spontaneously convert their energy into matter, antimatter, particle pairs, which immediately thereafter annihilate, returning their energy back to photons. Yes, antimatter is real, and we discovered it, not science fiction writers. These transmogrifications are entirely prescribed by Einstein's most famous equation, E equals mc squared, which is two-way recipe for how much matter your energy is worth and how much energy your matter is worth. The c squared is the speed of light squared, a huge number which, when multiplied by the mass, reminds us of how much energy you actually get in this exercise. Shortly before, during, and after the strong and electroweak forces parted company, the universe was a seething soup of quarks, leptons, and their antimatter siblings, along with bosons, the particles that enable their interactions. None of these particle families is thought to be divisible into anything smaller or more basic, though each comes in several varieties. The ordinary photon is a member of the boson family. The leptons, most familiar to the non-physicists, are the electron and perhaps the neutrino. And the most familiar quarks are, well, there are no familiar quarks. Each of their six subspecies has been assigned an abstract name that serves no real theological and philosophical and pedagogical purpose, except to distinguish it from the others up and down, strange and charmed, and top and bottom. Bosons, by the way, are named for the Indian science Sartina Nath Bose. The word lepton derives from the Greek leptos, meaning light or small. Quark, however, has a literary and far more imaginative origin. The physicist Murray Gell-Mann, who in 1964 proposed the existence of quarks as the internal constituents of neutrons and protons, and who at the time thought the quark family had only three members, drew the name from a characteristically elusive line in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. Three quarks for muster mark. One thing quarks do have going for them, all their names are simple. Something kind of biologists and especially geologists have seemed incapable of achieving when naming their own stuff. Quarks are quirky beasts. Unlike protons, each with an electric charge of plus one and electrons with a charge of negative one. Quarks have fractional charges that come in thirds, and you'll never catch a quark all by itself. It will always be clutching other sparks nearby. In fact, the force that keeps two or more of them together actually grows stronger the more you separate them, as if they were attracted by some sort of subnuclear rubber band. Separate the quarks enough, the rubber band snaps, and the stored energy summons E equals mc squared to create a new quark at each end, leaving you back where you started. During the quark lepton era, the universe was dense enough for the average separation between unattached quarks to rival the separation between attached quarks. Under those conditions, allegiance between adjacent quarks could not be ambiguously established, and they moved freely among themselves in spite of being collectively bound to one another. The discovery of the state of matter, a kind of quark cauldron, was reported for the first time in 2002 by a team of physicists at the Brookhaven National Laboratories, Long Island, New York. Strong theoretical evidence suggests that an episode of the very early universe, perhaps during one of the four splits, endowed the universe with a remarkably asymmetric in which particles of matter barely outnumber particles of antimatter by about 1 billion to 1 billion. That small difference in population would hardly get noticed by anybody amid the continuous creation, annihilation, and recreation of quarks and anti-quarks, electrons and anti-electrons, better known as positrons, and neutrinos and anti-neutrinos. The odd man out had oodles of opportunities to find somebody to annihilate with, and so did everybody else. But not for much longer. As the cosmos continued to expand and cool, growing larger than the size of our solar system, the temperature dropped rapidly between a trillion degrees Kelvin. A million of a second has passed since the beginning. This tepid universe was no longer hot enough or dense enough to cook quarks, and so they all grabbed dancing partners, creating a permanent new family of heavy particles called hardons. A Greek hardos, meaning thick. That quark to hardon transition soon resulted in the emergence of protons and neutrons, as well as other less familiar heavy particles, all composed of various combinations of quark species. In Switzerland, back of Earth, the European Particle Physicists Collaboration uses a large accelerator to collide beams of hardons in an attempt to recreate these very conditions. This largest machine in the world is sensibly called the Large Hadron Collider. A slight matter-antimatter asymmetry afflicting the quark lepton soup now passed through the hardons, but with extraordinary consequences. As this universe continued to cool, the amount of energy available for the spontaneous creation of basic particles dropped. During the hardon era, ambient photons could no longer evoke E equals mc squared to manufacture quark anti-quark pairs. Not only that, the photons that emerged from all the remaining annihilations lost energy to the very expanding universe, dropping below the threshold required to create hardon anti-hardon pairs. For every billion annihilations, leaving a billion photons in their wake, a single hardon survived. Those loners would get to have all the fun, serving as the ultimate source of matter to create galaxies, stars, planets, and pinunas. Without the billion and billion to billion imbalance between matter and antimatter, all mass in the universe would have self-annihilated, leaving a cosmos made of photons and nothing else. The ultimate let there be light scenario. By now, 1 second of time has passed. The universe has grown to a few light years across, about the distance from the sun to the closest neighboring stars. at a billion degrees, it's still plenty hot and still able to cook electrons, which, along their positron counterparts, continue to pop in and out of existence. But in the ever-expanding, ever-cooling universe, their days, seconds really, are numbered. What are true for quarks and true for hadrons had become true for electrons eventually. Only one electron in a billion survives. The rest annihilate with positrons, their antimatter sidekicks, in a sea of photons. Right about now, one electron for every proton has been frozen into existence. As the cosmos continues to cool, dropping below 100 million degrees, photons fuse with protons as well as with neutrons, forming atomic nuclei and hatching a universe in which 90% of these nuclei are hydrogen and 10% are helium, along with trace amounts of deuterium, heavy hydrogen, tritium, even heavier hydrogen, and lithium. 2 minutes have passed since the beginning. For another 380,000 years, not much will happen to other particle soup. Throughout these millennia, the temperature remains hot enough for electrons to roam free along the photons, batting them to and fro as they interact with one another. But this freedom comes to an abrupt end when the temperature of the universe falls below 3,000 degrees Kelvin and about half the temperature of the sun's surface, and all the free electrons combined with nuclei. The marriage leaves behind a bath of visible light, forever imprinting the sky with a record of where all the matter was in the moment, and completing the formation of particles and atoms in the primordial universe. For the first billion years, the universe continued to expand and cool as matter gravitated into mass to massive concentrations of what we call galaxies. Nearly 100 billion of them formed, each continuing hundreds of billions of stars and undergo theonuclear fusion in their cores. These stars, with more than about 10 times the mass of the sun, achieve sufficient pressure and temperature in their cores to manufacture dozens of elements heavier than hydrogen, including those that compose planets and whatever life may thrive upon them. These elements would be stunningly useless were they to remain where they formed, but high-mass stars gratuitously explode, scattering their chemically enriched guts throughout the galaxy. After 9 billion years of such enrichment, in an undistinguished part of the universe, the outskirts of Virgo's supercluster, in an undistinguished galaxy, the Milky Way, in an undistinguished origin, the Orion Arm, an undistinguished star, the Sun, was born. The gas cloud from which the sun formed contained a sufficient supply of heavy elements to soak this and spawn a complex inventory of orbiting objects that includes several rocky and gaseous planets, hundreds of thousands of asteroids, and billions of comets. For the first several 100 million years, large quantities of leftover debris and wayward orbits would accrete into larger bodies. This occurred in the form of high-speed, high-energy impacts, which rendered molten the surfaces of rocky planets, preventing the formation of complex molecules. As less and less credible matter remained in the solar system, planet surfaces began to cool. The one we call Earth formed in a kind of Goldilocks zone around the sun, where oceans remained largely in liquid form. Had Earth been